Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, June 9th. The World Cup is just days away. We talk about preparing for extreme weather in multiple locations as we get into the El Nino summer season, how Hawaii is involved. We also get the latest on a decision by Hawaii's largest health insurer that stands to impact healthcare across the state. And could a blood test help determine the risk of heart attacks and strokes? A major medical association is recommending everyone get tested. Plus, we highlight one small effort to deal with plastics pollution. We head to the Big Island to learn about upcycling Hawaii. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Countdown to the World Cup. 3-2-1. The FIFA soccer games kick off on Thursday. And this morning we talk about preparing for such an event that's being staged in 16 cities across three countries in North America. University of Hawaii planning professor Carl Kim heads a group that's been funded to look at the weather risks of excessive heat and the threat of storms, from lightning and thunderstorms to tornadoes, as well as flash flooding and fires. Kim dropped by our studio earlier this morning to talk about what it takes to prepare for such a massive international event. We were also joined by Tom Chandler of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. And we also hear from former University of Hawaii climate resilience scientist Danielle Spirandelli, who is now with the national firm Haley and Aldrich in Portland. Kim starts us off.
Well, yes, this is a huge international event. And as you know, soccer or football, as it's called in many places, is an enormously popular sport. It's growing in popularity, and it's probably the most played, most popular sport. And because of that, there's lots of attention, and millions of people will be coming to the United States, which is the host, along with Canada and Mexico, for the World Cup Games, which will begin Thursday and run through July. And what it's really interesting is that it's occurring in 11 different cities across the nation, which have very, very different weather-related conditions and capabilities to manage severe weather events. Our focus is on natural hazards. I direct the FEMA-funded National Disaster Preparedness Training Center, which develops and delivers training courses for first responders and emergency managers across the nation. We're part of the National Domestic Preparedness Consortium, but this research and training is also supported by the U.S. Department of Transportation. We have a Pacific Southwest Region 9 University Transportation Center, and then also a Federal Railroad Administration CRISI grant to support rail security and rail safety. And a lot of the spectators and people working at the stadiums will be commuting by rail. So that's the connection for us. Our focus is on weather hazards and then the preparedness. I mean, others are focused on terrorism and counterterrorism, but our focus is much more on risk management and the use of various technologies to support planning and decision making and preparedness for events like the World Cup. But also, we have to deal with other hazards and threats. So this is all part of the work that we do.
Well, I was flashing back to when we had the APEC summit here with all the world leaders and all the preparation that went into that, because it was very sensitive politically. We're all the way out here, and, you know, could we pull it off? And we did. But I just remember all the planning that went into that. And I'm sure, yeah, for something on this scale, and it's all training, right? You get better, you learn from these different events. And we are going to be hosting the Olympics, and so that's a whole nother layer that we have to consider, right?
Yes.
How do we prepare for
that? Yes, and so planning and preparedness and risk management and understanding the different hazards and threats is part of the work that we do. And so in order to do this, what we tried to do was to bring in national experts in extreme weather events and in urban planning and transportation to support the work that we're doing, both for the World Cup, but also for the Olympics and other hazards as well, too. I mean, I want to remind you, too, that at the same time, too, you know, just because we have the World Cup doesn't mean these other hazards. I mean, this past weekend, we had a tsunami threat. We've had the ongoing volcanic eruptions. We had earthquakes, you know, on the Big Island. We had the Kona low storms as well, too. And just because we're having the World Cup doesn't mean this other stuff stops, too. So it's been a very, very busy time for us and many of the partners that we work with.
Tom, maybe this is a good time for you to jump in here because, you know, New York City, I mean, you know, you've had a turn or two at planning big events and dealing with the risks.
Yeah, I've been collaborating with Carl and the University of Hawaii team for many years and have been giving the East Coast perspective on a lot of these areas. And I'm at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. And we've conducted trainings for emergency managers and first responders since way back in 2001 on themes like risk communication, mass care, and extreme weather for things like heat mitigation planning. We've also been working with the New York, New Jersey Stadium, otherwise known as MetLife. It's a challenge for me to say the new name on a lot of these issues. And there will be several matches at MetLife in June and July, including the final match on July 19th. And the Meadowlands as a region of New Jersey is really prone to flooding, intense thunderstorms, and heat waves in the summer months. So there's, as you said, there's an enormous amount to prepare for it. We've also been sharing some of the Northern New Jersey and New York City experiences in relation to developing weather planning scenarios for lightning, tornadoes, and wildfire particulate, which has been a really new and growing concern in a lot of ways. And I've also been working with Carl and Danielle to bring in several subject matter experts in meteorology, urban planning, as well as behavioral psychology to better understand fan behavior during large-scale sporting events in the event that there is extreme weather. And so at the end of the day, I think that this project really highlights the need for collaboration among stadium officials, mass transit, and local, county, state, and federal agencies.
Well, you know, I just arrived, I had stopped through the Bay Area, and they were preparing for their event at Santa Clara. And I was talking to the taxi cab drivers and the Uber drivers, and I'm like, oh, gosh, you know, you're expecting an onslaught? You prepared for this? And they didn't realize that it was happening this week. And I was like, okay,
yeah.
You know. But it was interesting, you know, the messaging that they were trying to get out through the media about what to expect. And they were talking about drone safety and crowd safety. But all that is, top of mind. But you have these natural disaster weather events. You know, when I was there, it was just warming up. So I can imagine, you know, the heat risk, right, in these cities across the globe, what that might mean for late in the afternoon when a lot of these games take place.
Yeah. And the issue that it's an international event brings in a whole new slew of issues in relation to the duration of the event and the language issues for risk communication for extreme weather that people who may not be familiar with the warning systems or the emergency procedures. There is a lot of apps that could potentially be used, but are they in the right language to meet all of the participants in the event? And so there's a lot of issues in relation to behavioral psychology and working with the audience to determine the best procedures for this to be an experience that everyone can benefit from.
Yes, and, you know, I know the messaging about you've got more than a dozen languages, you know, that you have to deal with. And I know I was very reliant on those maps when I was walking around, you know, Chicago in the Bay Area, but they didn't always work.
Yeah, it's 40 languages, you know, for their 48 different countries that are participating in this, and so at least 40 different languages.
So a challenge.
Yeah, it's quite challenging.
And Danielle, maybe you should pipe up here, you know, because the climate risk is different for these cities, right? Not everybody gets tornadoes. Not everybody is vulnerable to certain types of weather-related events that you're looking at.
That's right, yeah. It's about sort of the likelihood and what we might expect in a particular area at a particular time. And so we've been looking at these locations of the 11 host cities and what hazards we might expect in those particular areas during the summer months. And, you know, the work that I do, I'm a climate resilience specialist, but I'm also an urban planner. And my group at Haley and Aldrich were a variety of environmental scientists as well as wildfire experts. And so we've been doing a lot of work on various different environmental hazards across the country. And we look at that in relation to infrastructure, to local populations and communities, and their sensitivities to those particular hazards and risks. You know, when it comes to wildfire in particular, we've been working with Dr. Kim and the University of Hawaii and doing some of this focused work on looking at how wildfire might impact rail and the implications for local communities. We've also been doing work in terms of some of the debris, you know, management, you know, especially following the Lahaina fires in Maui. We don't expect, you know, the World Cup stadiums to, you know, likely burn because of wildfire, but they would more likely be impacted by poor air quality and smoke. And I think, you know, so we need to be prepared for that, and we need to be, you know, have our mitigation strategies sort of like ready to deploy, you know, things like, of course, N95 masks. We want to be able to have ways to limit the exposure, outdoor exposure. But, you know, we might also need to postpone or delay games if it gets really bad. And so be ready for that. But, you know, there are other hazards in other locations, in other areas, such as lightning and tornado. Those are very hard to predict, and those could come on very quickly. So similarly, need to be ready and prepared and have our situational awareness in terms of weather conditions change rapidly. And, of course, we're also focused on extreme heat, you know, things like make sure that we have enough water available, that there's shaded areas, not just, you know, in the stadium itself, but all of those areas surrounding where the fan zones are, transportation areas where people are moving, coming and leaving, need to have shaded areas, cooling stations, really limit the exposure. And then, you know, of course, I want to also bring up the fact that water bottles have been banned in terms of people being able to bring in their own water bottles. So we'll need to make sure that people have access to water if there is a heat event that happens in any one of these locations.
Yeah, and you hope that they don't jack up the prices. So, you know, you want to be able to make sure that people are going to be safe and have access to what they need. Because those stadiums are not cookie-cutter stadiums, right? Some are covered, some are open, and you have to consider all those risks.
That's absolutely right. That's right. Yeah, and as part of that, that's so critical is just the need for communication, the coordination, the collaboration. You know, the emergency managers on the ground, they've got a really heavy lift in terms of making sure that they're on target with their communication and the coordination. As Tom mentioned, there's going to be many, many languages, and it's some, you know, many people that are very new to these areas, and they may not have access to Wi-Fi. They may not have access to cell service or the apps. And so multiple messaging is going to be critical.
We've been hearing from climate scientist Danielle Spirindelli, Columbia University's Tom Chandler, and University of Hawaii Professor Carl Kim. We'll be right back after a short break.
support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
HPR is a unifier, a place where we can come together to stay informed, learn about our world, and experience music that feeds the soul. You can secure this resource for future generations when you include HPR in your will or estate plan. It's a simple but profound way to give, and an enduring investment in the future of this station. For more information about giving a gift through your will, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. In Divine Disruption, The Art of Tseren Chirpa, the Nepalese artist explores issues such as migration and identity. Now on view, honolulumuseum.org.
Let's get back to our conversation with part of a team focused on preparing for extreme weather events that could impact the World Cup soccer games, which kick off on Thursday. UH planning professor Carl Kim picks up the conversation.
Yeah, it's been really fascinating. We started working on this intently about 3 months ago. And as it gets closer to the games, we know more and more about the games and then but also the weather predictions as well, too. So we had these time blocks. We were looking 3 months before, a month before, a week before, the day of, because I think that there's different levels of knowledge and certainty that we will have as we get closer to the day.
Yeah, and now you have good data, right, or better data to model off of, and then that way you can assess everybody's risk.
Yes, yes. And that's the interesting part about this, that we focus this on the five top hazards that we were concerned with, but we also have the locations and start times of the games, and then we have the historic weather data for the different hazards and threats. And so we're able to pull that together to identify the most likely hazards and the ones that would cause the potentially greatest harm and disruption, not just to the fans and the players and the thousands of people coming to the facilities, but also for the areas which have transportation services and other things that are happening at the same time too.
Yeah, I mean, you want to get people to the event and away from the event safely.
Right. Nice.
And then in the event of a natural disaster or man-made disaster, yeah, how do you respond? You know, where do you have the triage centers, right? How do you treat the people that need help? Mm-hmm. But anything else, Tom, that you think would be important to underscore as we get closer to this date?
Yeah, just that this training effort really fostered systems thinking in a lot of ways, that each one of these stadiums has unique bottlenecks in relation to transportation and many of the issues surrounding the stadium and the surrounding neighborhoods, such as in MetLife, there's a station called Secaucus Junction where you have to do a transfer, and that poses a lot of challenges in relation to mass transit to the games, which is really being encouraged. And it just gets into the issues that there's things like infrastructure, things like what stadium officials and managers, emergency managers, transit officials need to know, what the general public needs to know in preparation for extreme weather, and then all these different organizations being able to communicate in real time for emergency management and safety is an enormous challenge. And there's been a really impressive effort by so many of the staff at these stadiums to address these issues that it's just been awe-inspiring in a lot of ways and great to see. So we just hope that this education program continues.
And then anything else you would like to underscore, Danielle?
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate what Tom was saying, I mean, there's been months and months and months of preparations that have been going on around the host cities. And part of those preparations has been the coordination between transportation and venue facilities and emergency management, and just how critical that is, making sure that there are pre-scripted messages in place, you know, that there are shelter-in-place drills that are being conducted, that, you know, the pre-scripted messaging has multiple languages, you know, all of that that is being developed over time and at the state level and then also at the local level. And so much incredible work that's being done and will continue to be done. And there'll be a lot to learn from as well.
And then final thoughts, Carl?
Well, they're really valuable lessons in terms of what we can do to reduce the risk. I mean, it's about information and communications. It's about training and preparedness. It's about knowing what to do and who's making the decisions related to postponing games or if we have to shelter in place or seek shelter. And then I think there are really hazard-specific actions that can be taken, you know, for high heat, for lightning risk, for tornadoes, for flash flooding, and then air quality. We've also been using AI to support. We use a lot of AI tools in our work, our classification problems. But what we wanted to do, because we know that people are using ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini and others, and so we've been running standard prompts as to the risks at the different locations and then compiling the results and comparing the differences. And I think this supports both our understanding of what the risk is at the particular locations and times, but also the use of these tools, these decision support tools, because like it or not, people are using these tools. And so we're incorporating this, not just about risk management, but the use of decision support tools into the training and course development and capacity building that we do at the university and with our partners in the emergency management and transportation and community resilience domains.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. We have the technology and we can use the experience, institutional, you know, memories of officials who have lived through whether the wildfires or the floods just to be able to keep everybody safe. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for you know, giving up your time to talk about this important issue. Thank you.
Well,
thank you. And we want to thank all of our partners with the state and local governments and the stadium authorities and the transportation agencies and so many other people that have really sort of come together and supported this collaborative effort to share information and work together to ensure safety and security for all.
That was Carl Kim, Tom Chandler, and Danielle Spirandelli, who are focused on planning for weather-related risks to the World Cup events that kick off this Thursday, and they run through July. Other teams are looking at other security-related issues around the international games, which can often be a target for terrorist groups because of the geopolitical tensions across the globe. This morning, we have news of a temporary reprieve. It's a development with a story that Honolulu Civil Beat broke last month after hearing from doctors about a change in billing that HMSA was planning on implementing next month. Reporter Stuart Yurton joins us live this morning. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so a lot has changed in a couple of weeks.
A lot has changed. That's right. At the beginning of May, HMSA sent notices to primary care doctors saying, we are going to change the way we reimburse you. It's a huge change. Instead of getting paid what amounts to a monthly allowance per patient to care for all their patients, HMSA said, we are going to pay you for services rendered, for doctor's visits. And it might seem like a small technical thing, but for the doctors, it was an enormous change.
Yeah, and we're talking big impacts, you know, across the state, right? Particularly in remote areas.
Yes, in remote areas where there aren't a lot of primary care doctors to begin with, it really affects them. Some are saying, we don't know how we're going to be able to keep the doors open, keep the lights on with this change. That, of course, affects the patients everywhere. So really a huge impact on doctors and patients. And again, it was just, this was too fast. HMSA told them in May that we're changing this in July. So they really only had 60 days to totally shift the way they were running their doctor's offices. And again, for patients, it could mean all kinds of things where, for instance, instead of being able to get help on the phone from the doctor might say, well, you need to come in and we'll see you. So it's less convenient for the patients and the doctors and everybody.
Yeah. And what changed is the doctors also reached out besides the media, but also to Governor Josh Green.
Yes, the doctors reached out to Governor Josh Green. They reached out to Dr. Jack Lewin, who's head of the state health planning agency, really a point person for the governor. And they were really pushing on this. And again, Dr. Lewin was very aware of the situation, and sounds like Governor Green was too. So he finally stepped in. He's really tried to stay out of a lot of this stuff, but he stepped in on this one and convinced HMSA to give the doctors 6 months extra to get what they needed to do in order so they could make the change.
Yes, and we should point out, though, that this is happening while HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health were talking about a new system, they were being pretty careful about, you know, whether this was a part of that plan or not.
Well, right. Now, this is what's strange about it. We'll call the monthly allowance payment model. That is something that the One Health people were saying, this is really working. Hawaii Pacific Health has figured out how to make this work, and it's working so well that we're using it for all of our doctor group. And this includes individual, private, independent doctors, and as well as the Hawaii Pacific Health employed doctors. So they had a lot of doctors using it. They were using it throughout their system of doctors, including specialists, and they were saying it's working and we want to expand it to One Health, and because we've shown that we can make this work and we can save money and keep people healthy and all of that. Well, suddenly HMSA comes in and says, we're switching away from that model. So it's a very strange situation. Mark Mugiishi, the doctor who heads HMSA, explained that it's not exactly that they're moving away from it. They are, but he said what One Health is talking about doing is this global monthly allowance. They're only talking about taking the monthly allowance away from primary care doctors, which frankly are the only ones that use it right now. And so Dr. Mugiishi was saying it's different, but still it raised questions to the point that the governor said, look, I want to make, he saw the discrepancy between what the One Health people were saying and what HMSA was doing, and he said, well, I need to try to make sure they're all on the same page with this. So that was a very interesting twist on this, and again, I think it left a lot of people scratching their heads, and frankly, it just didn't really help the One Health message that, hey, this global capitation model, as they call the monthly allowance model, is great, and we can make it work and expand it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, but you seem to get some sense that HPH was a bit surprised by all this. But, you know, we understand that they've got to be very careful about collusion as these deals kind of get worked out.
Well, right, and that's what Dr. Mugiishi said. He said, well, generally, yes, we are on the same page.
Right.
But then he said, but for this particular pivot, I'm not sure.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks so much, Stuart. Good story.
Thank you.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton. Read his coverage online at civilbeat.org. In full disclosure, HMSA is an HPR underwriter. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihau, o Molokai, o Lanai, o Maui, o Kahoolawe, o Hawaii.
As you heard earlier in the show, the World Cup kicks off later this week around cities in North America. To celebrate, we're taking you back to a short-lived professional soccer team in Honolulu. Who remembers Team Hawaii? The team played in the North American Soccer League for just one season in 1977, making it the only major professional soccer team to call Hawaii home. The team also put our state on the map as the first island in the Pacific to sport a pro soccer team. Unfortunately, Team Hawaii turned out to be a bit of a fumble for the state. The club lost roughly $500,000 due to poor attendance and high travel costs. It didn't help that they had to travel to the U.S. continent for its away matches. It mostly attended match only attracted a crowd of 12,000 at the Aloha Stadium, which had capacity for up to 50,000 fans. At the end of the 1977 season, fans speculated that the franchise would leave the Aloha State. For today's quiz, can you tell us where Team Hawaii moved to and what their new team name became? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
John Quincy Adams was a one-term president, but he became a maverick congressman who brought so many anti-slavery petitions to the floor, Southern congressmen wanted him out.
So they're threatening to censure a former president of the United States. I mean, just imagine that.
But Adams prevailed. How he did that proves even today that Congress can actually work. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
Could inflammation tell us about our heart health? We've long heard about the importance of managing our cholesterol, and especially LDL, when it comes to our risk for heart disease and stroke. But a Hawaii company is raising awareness about a newer test that they think is just as important for patients to know about. It's a blood test to measure a marker tied to inflammation. Last year, the American College of Cardiology recommended that everyone get tested and know their levels. David Watermill is a longtime entrepreneur and co-founder of Lokahi Longevity. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about what patients should know.
Well, this is a very important, we think, distinction in the medical space around cardiovascular risk. We all are familiar with LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol. But there's something else that's equally, if not more important, and it's called inflammation. And it turns out that if you have an inflammation issue, you can have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, including major adverse cardiovascular events like heart attack and stroke, or the need for revascularization, stents, et cetera. And if you can impact and reduce your inflammation significantly, you can reduce the number of heart attacks and strokes that a population may have. And so there's now a push by the American College of Cardiology, which is one of the most credible and professional heart organizations in the world, that is calling for universal. Every adult over 20 should be measured for something called HSCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein test. Before, you could ask your doctor for this, or your doctor might recommend it, but it was fairly expensive and was not covered by insurance. So what we've been able to do is to offer access to that study. We don't actually do the test ourselves. It'll be done at a local diagnostic laboratory setting. that would actually do the study for just $20.50. And we think it's important for the population here in Hawaii in particular to be aware of this cardiovascular breakthrough that hasn't been around for a long time. It's just the first announcement of this came late in 2025.
I think when people hear a blood test that can screen for inflammation, that'll tell you something about your heart health, they might think, I've heard this story before. It's a company called Theranos, and it went bankrupt. But the science is well supported when it comes to HSCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, being able to tell you something about your risk for stroke and cardiovascular events like heart attack.
Well, it does. And in fact, the scientific statement from the American College of Cardiology cites, I think, 16 different other studies that have been done that together form the foundation for the credibility of this cardiovascular marker called HSCRP to actually predict the level of risk. And one of the studies is called the Jupiter study. And in that study, what they found was that if you could lower HSCRP along with your cholesterol to designated levels, that you could reduce the risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, or MACE for short, by 44%.
Wow.
Yeah. And to do that across a huge population, the study had 17,000 people in it. So very credible and indicative of the other 15 studies that were done with also similar results across the, in different populations, but nevertheless important to the general health of the population.
And so you and Lokahi Longevity and the American College of Cardiology are saying we need to pay more attention to this marker and test for it. You're seeing that the landscape here in Hawaii right now, this is not something that a lot of people know about their own bodies or health.
No, and it's because it's new, especially the recommendation is new. We've known about CRP. We've actually been working on it for about 20 years in one of my other companies as well. So we understand the role of inflammation, but the actual foundation of the recommendation came just in late 2025. And so that is new. But I think that a lot of people are paying attention to the role of inflammation in aging. And we're finding pretty well accepted. In fact, there's a term for the combination of inflammation and aging called inflammaging. Sounds like a marketing term.
A little bit.
But it was actually invented, the term was invented by scientists to describe the interaction between aging and inflammation.
And so what you have done, though, is negotiate this $20.50 price with a diagnostic lab in Hawaii to be able to offer this testing. And as part of that, no one receives economic benefit from it.
Well, the labs make something.
Sure.
Yeah, of course they do. But we as Lokahi are not making anything from it. We're not charging a profit from it. And we're not selling the test or conducting it. We do think that it will start a conversation. And that conversation hopefully could lead to people's interest in Lokahi's larger programs that are also addressing longevity. But this is something that can be done now. It's very important, very scientifically and medically credible that is now available, that was not available for most people until just recently.
Talk a little bit more about what that means for people in Hawaii specifically, because we have a very distinctive ethnic makeup compared to the rest of the country, and that translates down into disease risk. So why is this sort of testing important?
Well, because no matter what part of the population you come from, inflammation plays a significant role, as does your LDL. Now, there's risk is greater in certain populations in Hawaii, in particular the Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander risk is higher than for Asian Americans. And Caucasians are somewhere in the middle there. But it doesn't prevent people of any ethnic group from having elevated inflammation and a need to look at their inflammation process. And so despite the fact that Native Hawaiians have a much higher risk and Asians have much less, even the Asians need to look at their HSCRP. And in fact, in one of the studies, again, the Jupiter study, if you got your level of HSCRP down to 1, and your LDL was 70 or below, your risk of major adverse cardiovascular events was down 80%. So if you think you're partway there, you can maybe able, you may should look at even moving things in the right direction in a more significant way than you may have thought possible. Even then, many physicians at this point in time have not followed necessarily all of this new breakthrough information.
Well, if people do get this test, if they find this information out about themselves, what do they do with that information?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because it's one thing to know that you have an elevated risk, others to be able to do something about it. And you want to be able to move the needle. You want to be able to move hsCRP in particular, and it turns out LDL, but they don't have to go in the same direction necessarily. Reducing one, the LDL, as we know, already has a positive impact, but it's not a complete impact. And if you add hsCRP to the mix, you have additional benefit independent of your LDL levels. And so what you want to be able to do is to move both of those downwards. And you can do that with statins, with a new drug that the FDA has approved recently called colchicine, and with some of the dietary supplements that are out there today that have demonstrated an impact on hsCRP and LDL cholesterol in studies as well.
Anything else that you would like to add that you want listeners to know? Because, I mean, at its very basic, what you're saying is that there's going to be this test available at this fixed price point, and it's information that could potentially save a life.
Well, that gets us up every morning, is to know that by doing a show like this or others, maybe we do have an impact on the lives of others. That's what the data tells us should happen, is that we should have an impact on it. Because I think everyone is going to know their hsCRP level like they know their LDL levels now. In the next several years of time, it will become not only commonplace, but a topic of cocktail conversation. What's your hsCRP? And, well, mine is better, you know, than yours, kind of like the LDL conversations that occur today.
And is this a ask your doctor about type of conversation, or will patients be able to go direct to lab for this?
Well, you certainly should ask and can ask your doctor about it, but this is new even to the physician community, this recommendation. But if it's not covered by insurance, or if the doctor doesn't feel the need to talk to you about it and you still want to talk about it, feel free to reach out to us. Our phone number is 808-723-5459. And we're happy to have an initial conversation. We're not physicians. We're not giving you your own medical advice, but we can talk about the role of inflammation and cardiovascular disease in general. And we'd be happy to chat about that.
That was David Wadamul, co-founder of Lokahi Longevity. He spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about a new blood test that's available that can tell you about your heart health and your risk for heart attack and stroke. We'll have links to learn more on our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Employers Council's annual Talent Summit, June 26th at the Ala Moana Hotel, bringing together stakeholders to address workforce challenges. Registration at hecouncil.org.
Are we ready for the World Cup, the NBA Finals, and Ultimate Fighting on the White House lawn all in the same week? On the next Fresh Air, we speak with Laura Williamson, editor-in-chief of The Athletic, about our summer of sports. From skyrocketing ticket prices to travel restrictions related to politics, the Iran war, and the Ebola outbreak. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001. We'll be right back.
Now it's time to blow the whistle on today's Backyard Quiz. Earlier, we reminisced about Hawaii's short-lived run on the professional soccer pitch. Team Hawaii, which called Aloha Stadium home, was rarely able to fill even a tenth of the stadium's 50,000-seat capacity. On the field, the team saw mixed success. They ended the 1977 season with an 11-15 record. Team Hawaii began as the San Antonio Thunder soccer team before moving to Honolulu. However, the islands were just another step in the rocky road for the North American Soccer League club. After a financially dismal season, fans speculated that the team would move to Milwaukee, Atlanta, or even Houston. We asked you to tell us what became of Team Hawaii. Well, on November 14, 1977, the team made the move to Tulsa and became the Tulsa Roughnecks. The Tulsa Roughnecks played professionally from 1978 to 1984 and even won the 1983 North American Soccer League Soccer Bowl, despite being the lowest-funded team in the league. They beat out the Toronto Blizzard to become the top dogs, and who doesn't love an underdog story? But that was our quiz, and Steve, who lives up in St. Louis Heights, he got the answer. He said he moved here to Hawaii from France in 1968, and he kind of liked soccer, so he knew the answer. But that's our Backyard Quiz for today. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Upcycle Hawaii is looking to be a part of the solution to our plastics pollution. The company is a small manufacturer in Hilo. It makes treasure out of trash. HBR contributor Betsy Brown joins us to talk about this small step to tackle a big problem. Good morning, Betsy.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what can you tell us about this company? I'm intrigued.
Yeah, well, Upcycle Hawaii has actually been making products on the Big Island for about 12 years now, and it's run by a woman who grew up here. Her name's Maddie Larson, and she told me that she just loves to make things. So she's making earrings, magnets, zipper pouches, keychains, and it's all out of waste. And that's because she realized as she was getting older and caring more and more about the environment that while she loved doing art, a lot of the materials she was using weren't good for the environment. So she looked at ways to make things from the waste around her.
It's all packaging trash that we collect from different businesses. So we melt it until it's thick enough for us to cut and sew. And then the scraps from our cutting and sewing process get re-shredded using the same rotary cutter and remelted at a thicker density to create all of our keychains, magnets, earrings, our thicker items. So we literally use all of our own waste here in our studio.
That's terrific.
Yeah, definitely. And what a strategy too, because there's plenty of plastic around us, right? That's one of our biggest problems. So she's helping get rid of things, but it's also lowering the cost of importing items, also lowering the environmental burden of importing things. So she's not relying on that, and that makes business expenses a little lower. But of course, we know this has been a very challenging time for businesses, especially small businesses, as they deal with rising costs. So I asked her a little bit about how things are affecting her, because the retail merchants of Hawaii had their businesses involved in a survey recently, and they said 86% of Hawaii businesses were impacted by tariffs, and 45% of local businesses were expecting a 10% or more profit decline this year. So I wanted to know how it's affecting her, even with this model of reuse. And she said, yeah, she's been feeling the impact so much that actually just at the end of May, she closed her storefront in downtown Hilo, and she's now running the business out of her living room. She said the shipping prices for her online sales have gone up, and she does most of her selling online or at farmers markets, but there's also been a drop in sales at the farmers markets early this year just from tourists spending a little bit less. But she said now that she's running out of her living room, she's going to keep the business going. She's still making products, and three other women work with her part-time. I saw pictures of the new studio. It looks really nice, all in her home, but there's plenty of space for them to work. And so they're going to keep creating. The plastic zipper pouches I mentioned earlier are her most popular item. But she said that, and it's then the earrings that she makes from that melted down plastic she was talking about, that remelted down plastic. It can take months or even years to make those things.
Our longer processes can take months, and many colors take years of collecting certain types of trash or colors of trash to actually make them happen. So we're at the whim of what colors come to us. We get a lot of blues and aquas, a lot less of literally everything else.
So she just pulls these things out of the waste stream and creates products with them. Amazing.
Yeah, and she mentioned the blues and aquas, and actually I asked her what her most commonly donated plastic is, and it is the wrapping for the Costco toilet paper.
Really?
So, yeah, she has just bags of that, and then also bags of their paper towels, and even menstrual product wrappings. They are using any kind of plastic that people bring in. But as far as the hardware that they use for, like, earring posts or the zippers themselves, those are items that she does have to buy or find recycled somehow. And so she says she purchases those items from sustainable companies, and she gets them recycled as much as she can. But these companies are also small businesses, and they've been affected by the recent economy. And she actually told me that she ordered the last three spools of thread from her recycled thread supplier. So she's just having a little bit of trouble getting items, but she's going to keep making things. They definitely have plenty of plastic. I saw a picture of her new space, and there's lots of bags full of wrapping. So they've also been keeping track of how much plastic they've used. And since 2018, when they started weighing the products that they make, they found that they have diverted 1,500 pounds of plastic from the landfill. And that's something that she and her customers feel good about.
I know specifically when it comes to earrings, our customers love that they're statement jewelry, that they start a conversation and that people can actually talk about plastics and waste and trash and recycling. Also just make people laugh because they can tell them their earrings are made from trash.
What a conversation starter, right? That
yes.
Your earrings are made from trash. Yeah, you can find her products at the Hilo Farmers Market actually today. And she's also there on Wednesdays, Saturdays, and every Tuesday. You can also look at their website, and we'll have a link on the HPR website later today.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Betsy. We have been hearing from HPR contributor Betsy Brown. She's based on the Big Island, and she spent some time with Upcycle Hawaii. That's a wrap for today. And you know, for tomorrow, the election season gearing up, we plan to take a closer look at the Maui mayor's race. Share your comments or questions about what you heard on our show by calling our talkback line 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation segments on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.